statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Tone and Tenor, a show that explores current issues of the day and listens to bipartisan voices of the people. We want to hear from you with your phone calls and on social media. Now, here are the hosts of Tone and Tenor.
Welcome to the Tone and Tenor Show, Bipartisan Voices of the People. I'm Randall Jefferson.
I'm Maurice Goodman.
Our show looks at major issues impacting the nation and region from a bipartisan perspective. We want to hear from you, our listeners. Call, ask questions of our guests. Our call-in number is 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306. Our phone lines are now open. You can also send us your comments via social media. Our Twitter handle is @ToneAndTenor. That's @TONEANDTenor, TENOR. You can also like us on our Facebook page. Just type in the words Tone and Tenor in the Facebook search engine to find us.
New localism is a problem-solving practice and governing philosophy for the 21st century. It emerged out of pragmatism, out of the need to rescue communities in decline, but it increasingly focused on linking local communities to the growth sectors of the global economy in ways both inclusive and environmentally sustainable. It embraces the devolution of responsibility and reflects the multidimensional nature of how problems are solved over the long term. Its success will require the development of new norms of growth, governance, and finance. That's on page 17 of the new book offered by Bruce Katz and Jeremy Nowak, called The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism. National government dysfunction has not served its constituents well. Polls show that, and citizens are taking action on a state, city, and community level. Power has shifted from a vertical top-down approach to a horizontal bottom-up approach. This new locus of power, this new localism, is emerging by necessity to solve the grand challenges of characteristics of modern societies: economic competitiveness, social inclusion and opportunity, a renewed public life, the challenge of diversity, and the imperative of environmental sustainability. Where rising populism on the right and the left exploits the grievances of those left behind in the global economy, new localism has developed as a mechanism to address them head on. Therefore, joining in our discussion today, and the topic being The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in Age of Populism, Mr. Bruce Katz, who's the co-founder of New Localism Advisors and the author of The New Localism. The mission of his firm, the New Localism Advisors, is to help cities design, finance, and deliver transformative initiatives that promote inclusive and sustainable growth. Mr. Katz is also the co-founder and inaugural director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University's Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation. The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism, is from the Brookings Institution Press, and the other book that he has written, The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy, also Brookings in 2013. Both books focus on the rise of cities and city networks as the world's leading problem solvers. Mr. Katz was the inaugural centennial scholar at the Brookings Institution from January 2016 to March 18, where he focused on the challenges and opportunities of global urbanization. Prior to assuming this role, Mr. Katz was a vice president of the Brookings Institution and founding director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. Before joining Brookings, Mr. Katz served as chief of staff to U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Mr. Henry Cisneros, and was a senior counsel and then staff director for the United States Senate Subcommittee on Housing and Urban Affairs. After the 2008 presidential election, Bruce co-led the Housing and Urban Transition Team for the Obama administration and served as a senior advisor to new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary Sean Donovan, for the first 100 days of the administration. Mr. Katz earned his BA from Brown University and his JD from Yale Law. Later on in the show, at about the 2:30 hour, Ms. Arshna Sahay, strategic advisor and thought leader, will join the show along with Mr. Katz to discuss the book and the legacy of Mr. Jeremy Nowak, who passed away recently. With her focus on areas that include urban innovation and ecosystem development, Arshna has worked in many areas, previously worked as the Director of Entrepreneurial Investments for the City of Philadelphia. She was responsible for the economic and business development of the tech sector. She also launched various programs to help connect entrepreneurs to resources needed as they built their businesses in Philadelphia. Arshna earned her bachelor's degree in finance derivatives from the Virginia Tech University. With that, we'll join in Mr. Katz with the show. Bruce, welcome to the Tone and Tenor Radio Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We really appreciate your time. This book is we're beginning to hear is got a considerable buzz going about it because there seems to be it seems to be quite timely. And so a lot of folks want to know what the nuke localism is all about and how is that going to move the dynamic of the growing number of cities from population to demographic flow. So we wanted to get a sense of what the book is about.
Well, I thought your introduction was really quite helpful, and I would say that what we're seeing in the United States and other parts of the world is a change in the philosophy and practice of problem solving. So you listed some of the tough challenges that are facing U.S. and global cities, whether it's around competitiveness or social mobility or climate change or demographic transformation. And I think what we're seeing is that solutions in this century are really coming bottom up, led by cities, rather than top down, led by national governments. They tend to be designed and then delivered by networks of institutions and sectors rather than by government alone. And they tend to be interdisciplinary, drawing from the expertise of people who come from a variety of backgrounds rather than driven by, let's say, a siloed government agency or bureaucracy. And to some extent, I think as your introduction laid out, this is partly a result of the collapse of national governments, many national governments, not just in the United States but beyond, have really been captured by an angry populism and to a large extent are on a frolic and a detour. They're not quite solving problems, they're more exploiting grievances. And so they've left it to quote-unquote lower levels of society to actually be the vanguard of problem solving. I actually think this is not a cyclical issue. I think this is a structural issue. In a networked economy, in a networked world, cities have almost become like a parallel operating system, and we're seeing really the beginning of a very different way of moving the 21st century forward.
Have we not had this tension before? Maybe, let's say, at the beginning of the Republic, where there was a debate about federalism and where there was a centralization debate at the top of the sunrise of the country. Would you agree with that? And has that been a tension that we never quite shaken and are now at a stage where we really do have to act on it?
I think that's a really interesting insight. I think the United States, going back to the founding of the Republic, if you look at the writings of de Tocqueville in the early part of the 19th century, really throughout the entire 19th century, the United States was a nation with a very weak center. The national government really did not perform many capacities, and to a large extent, the country was built by cities and states and by the private sector. As you moved into the 20th century, particularly because of the world wars, because of the Great Depression, you began to see the national government grow in size and stature. Really, the last 40 or 50 years, I think what we're seeing is more of a balanced return to the country, where the national government provides an essential platform for inclusive and sustainable and innovative growth and prosperity, both for the nation and for our people. But there's a much, I think, greater division of responsibilities between the center and really the broader nation. And so we've seen many ebbs and flows in the history of the Republic, and now we're going through just the latest sort of rebalancing of who's in charge, where does power lie?
But Bruce, this is Randall. When we talk about it, you brought that up very, very eloquently, that who's in charge, where does the power lie? Is there a difference? Because we're seeing that the cities and the states and, you know, they're playing the blame game, so to speak, most of the time, that if I can't get it through the city because the state is doing X, Y, Z, and then the state says the federal government isn't doing anything, how do we come up instead of come down? Because it seems like our politicians, especially in today's world, are even confused themselves. How do we address that?
I think it's a great question. I think there's a difference between cities, states, and the national government. Mm-hmm. The national government and states are just governments. Cities are networks. Those networks include local government and elected officials, but they also include universities, corporations, entrepreneurs, investors, philanthropies, and community and labor. And so, to a large extent, I think what has happened is, as the national government, like Elvis, has left the building, and many states are hostile and basically paralyzed by partisan rancor and division, the cities, because they're networks and can't really be hijacked by the same kind of partisanship or ideological polarization, the cities have stood up, sometimes in unison across multiple sectors, sometimes led by mayors, sometimes, frankly, led by university presidents or heads of philanthropies or corporations or communities. Mm. The cities have stood up and said, look, we have real problems here. If the higher, quote unquote, the higher levels of our society aren't going to get the business done, we'll do it ourselves. And then we're going to create new norms and standards that then can be replicated and adapted across the country.
So in effect, the kids have taken over the household because the grown-ups don't seem to know how to run the household. But yet now the kids have gotten creative.
I think so. And I think, you know, we have this sort of sense of a hierarchy in the United States and, frankly, around the world. The national government, the president, the prime ministers, they're in charge. They run the country.
Right.
That's not really how the country works. You know, we're a very diverse, very large, very expansive nation. If we really were relying on the president or senior members of Congress to, quote unquote, run the country, I don't think we would be the most entrepreneurial or innovative place in the world.
Mm.
What we have is a broad civil society that has been able, you know, over really generations, over centuries, to build a very unique and distinctive way of nation building from the bottom up. Mm. And I think that at a time of angry populism, that means that the health of our republic can't be measured by, you know, the number of presidential tweets, but frankly by the kind of problem-solving and innovation which is happening in cities and counties all across the country.
But why can't it, though, Bruce? I mean, we could use the presidential tweets from time to time. I am being facetious. From time to time, in terms of maybe there's some guidance in the city's going, okay, so we're on our own, and so we got to get going.
I think, look, it would be wonderful to get back to where we were, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, where we had more bipartisanship and where we had an understanding that there are central roles that a national government must perform. It must be the major investor in the safety net.
The Lincoln, you know? the Lincoln philosophy, if you will. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It must defend the homeland. Right. It has to basically have basic rules for the market, for civil rights enforcement, et cetera, et cetera. It must invest at scale in research and development. There's some things that a national government must do. But frankly, the way the U.S. operates, more than just about any other country in the world, there's a whole bunch of stuff that the national government might be involved in, might be a junior investor in. Mm-hmm. Think about education. Only 10 cents of every dollar comes from the national government. But the U.S., I think, is successful in part because so much is delegated and distributed to the rest of the republic.
Mm. Walk us through some of the state of play in the new localism. It's not just a U.S. thing. It is a global thing as well. What are some of the mechanisms that are actually working? You talked about public-private partnerships. You talked about community organizations, grassroots organizations, millennials, let's say, deciding finally to dive into the pool, to the deep end of the pool and take part in civic in the civic discussion. What are some of the things that are working out there that you're seeing?
So when you read the book, we're very focused on coming out of Northern Europe, out of Denmark, out of Germany mm-hmm. in particular, public-private institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So not public-private transactions, which is the way the U.S. tends to think about it, but institutions, corporations that are publicly owned but professionally managed. So there's a big story in the book about Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. 30 years ago, Copenhagen mm-hmm. was flat on its back. It was had 18% unemployment. It was fiscally bankrupt because it had lost its role and function as a major port. So what it did was it transferred all the public assets, all the land, all the buildings that the government owned, either the national government or the local government or special authorities. It transferred all that land along the harbor and in the area between the downtown and the airport to one corporation, the Copenhagen City and Port Development Corporation.
Hmm.
And it basically said to this corporation, redevelop, regenerate the core of the city, and all the revenue that you get from that regeneration goes to service the debt on a modern citywide transit system. So if you go to Copenhagen today, it's the third wealthiest city in the world, major transformation since 30 years ago. But also it has a major transit system, state-of-the-art, that was not built with a dollar or a kroner of taxes. It was built from the revenues from the land, sale and leasing of land. The U.S. doesn't quite operate like that. We do have very sophisticated financial mechanisms like tax increment financing. Your Navy Yard has done a phenomenal job. The Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation
mm-hmm.
is one of the most competent of the public-oriented entities in the U.S. But the mechanisms used in Northern Europe, particularly in places like Hamburg, Berlin, and Copenhagen, I think could be replicated and adapted to the U.S. That's new localism.
And that was a driver of why you wrote the book? I mean, what was one of the key drivers? Because that is a powerful story and a very innovative one. When you and Mr. Nowak got together and decided to write it, what was one of the key drivers?
I think one of the key drivers for us is when your national government like ours is completely dysfunctional, how do you fund the future? Because, you know, a five-year-old today, if we have 10 years of dysfunction, we'll be 15.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll be almost at the point where they need to enter the labor market. They can't wait for the national government to get its act together, right?
Mm.
We can't wait for infrastructure to collapse before we reinvest in infrastructure. We have to, and you know, Arshin knows quite a bit about this, the commercialization of research, entrepreneurship. We have to keep the country moving forward. So then the question becomes, how do you fund the future when your national government essentially has had a lobotomy? You unlock public wealth, which is what they've done in Hamburg and Copenhagen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You harness private and civic capital, like we do very well in the U.S. in many places. Or you go to the voters and you ask them to make systemic investments in infrastructure or in children, as many parts of the country have done. So what we're basically saying is this may not be the best way to run a railroad, but, in our current civic life, power and responsibility has been pushed down to cities and counties and to networks of institutions and leaders. Now we have to create a new mechanism for growth, governance, and finance.
All right, so that begs a question. How are we doing as a citizenry in pushing that local leader, that business leader, that nonprofit leader to do the new localism that you're speaking of? Are we being as effective as holding their feet to the fire as we're trying to be effective on the national government? And are they, the leaders, organically understanding that, yes, we do have to act, and we're going to act, and here are some of the things we're doing, and is the citizenry tweaking the messages that they're trying to give to us to get that movement afoot?
I think that's really a great question. I think here's the challenge we have in the U.S., and frankly we have in many parts of the world, is we still have a 20th century narrative and paradigm for how a country actually functions. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and I used to watch something called Schoolhouse Rocks, you know?
Sure.
And on, you know, a cartoon every Saturday. And
I'm just a bill.
Yeah, I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. So if you turned on the media every day in the United States, our national media, you would think that the country's run from the White House.
Absolutely.
And attention paid to the dysfunction in that particular building. The fact of the matter is, we still are the most powerful economy in the world, is because we're not run from the center. And so I'm not sure the citizenry, because they are bombarded day in and day out with this hierarchical notion of who, quote unquote, runs the country, or they're basically told, look to your local government many times to solve many problems. I think the narrative and our understanding of how the country actually functions is out of whack and out of date. So I'm now running a new lab at Drexel called the NOAC Metro Finance Lab, because Metro Finance basically is the aggregate of public, private, and civic capital that then gets dedicated to solve problems. We have Unifinance, which is basically cities going to the capital markets. Metro Finance is the aggregate of public, private, and civic. That's the new paradigm. That's the way we operate. I think our narrative is a little out of date and misaligned with the realities of how the country functions.
But Bruce, but when we talk about, you know, we keep talking about civics, and all of us here probably at one time or another prior to college, if they went to college, had some sort of civics. And you touched on it earlier about the executive branch. Is part of that problem today is that we don't have an informed citizenship, because those things have been removed from the lower level schooling, and we now have to wait. If you go to a Drexel or for policy, or to a George Mason, or to a George Washington, or to a Yale, or some other institution of higher learning, then we are hit with this reality of, oh, there is three branches of government. Most people today don't realize that there are three branches of government and what the functionality is. How is that part of this problem as well?
I think that, I do think nations like ours, or cities like Philadelphia and metropolitan areas like Philadelphia, are messy, complex organisms. That's part of their strength, but it's also part of the difficulty with citizenry or even leadership to really get their arms around it. And we don't really teach civics in the U.S., or if we do, even when you get to college or graduate schools, we teach public administration, which is what I'm describing is network governance.
Okay.
The way the world actually operates is public, private, and civic together. Sometimes collaborative, sometimes, you know, conflict. in the city of brotherly love, there's always a bit of conflict going on. But
that's where it all started at.
And an understatement. Yes.
Yeah. So I would agree that we're having a difficult time expressing how this country or any major modern society operates in the 21st century, which is essentially a network society, network economy, highly connected globally, versus the 20th century, which is, I think, the hierarchies that we use, national government, the states, the bill on Capitol Hill, those held for a while. Mm-hmm. But we're now moved into a different kind of realm. And to some extent, our civic education hasn't kept up.
So what has to happen is that the dinosaurs that are in the room that have been there for 10, 20, 30 years need to either step up and come into the 21st century or be removed, because they're part of our problem, and our problems across the country is that we keep people in places and they're not changing with the times. Our cities aren't changing with the times. And, you know, we talk about infrastructure. We talk about things falling apart. But if we started changing with the times and reality and got rid of the fossils that were in the room because they're not seeing what's really going on, would that help with the new localism? Would that help our cities? Would that help us as the citizens of these United States understand their role as a citizen, regardless whether the United States or around the globe?
I think to some extent the challenge or the opportunity, it depends how you want to look at this, is for major institutions in every American city and metropolis to change their understanding of their role and how they do their business. I mean, I'm at Drexel in part because I think Drexel is probably the most civically engaged university in the United States. Mm. The way in which applied education and community service is built into the DNA of this university is not how most universities operate in the U.S. So individual institutions, whether you're a major corporation, university, hospital, philanthropy, have to change. And then what we need to build is a culture across sectors and institutions of collaborating to compete.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No. I do think that if you believe that cities have to fund the future, we're going to need to, and this is why the book talks about places like Indianapolis and Cincinnati and St. Louis and Pittsburgh as examples where major institutions are working together to unlock large amounts of private and civic wealth and therefore helping to grow the economy in very inclusive ways.
Would you not consider that there needs to be a triggering point, for lack of a better term? In other words, where do we engage the sense of urgency from the institutions to the populace and even to give federal government notice that, you know what, we're just going to have to figure this out on a local level? What is the trigger point of the sense of urgency? Because we can hear what you're saying. The average citizen would go, okay, that's Ivory Tower. But brilliant thought, but Ivory Tower. But what does this mean for me? And what if we don't do this? What makes me act?
Well, if I think the memo that's come out of Washington, it's de facto, is, by the way, the rest of the country, you're in charge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we occasionally can do a few things, but the kind of functionality that we used to have at the national government level has really ceased to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone doesn't feel a level of urgency, they may be like Rip Van Winkle thinking it's circa 1975 here. I do think that the book lays out very practical and pragmatic examples of cities that, frankly, like Copenhagen, felt that the bottom had dropped out. Think of Pittsburgh at the end of the 70s when the steel industry left. Or think about places like Indianapolis when essentially if you went there in the mid-70s or mid-80s, there wasn't a person on the streets of the downtown after 5 o'clock. You know, so a bunch of places began to basically say to themselves, we better get our act together locally if we're going to be able to build a robust economy, the kind of 21st century infrastructure, skilled workforce, decent education systems, because there's no one home at many higher levels of government to do all the myriad of things that have to be done. So I would say this is a period of great urgency. And you have, you know, what Philadelphia has more than most American cities and metropolitan areas are incredible institutions with huge amounts of capital and talent, and then probably some of the best urban practitioners in the country. I mean, people look to Philadelphia to, you know, when they are thinking about what's the next generation of skills training or which is the best kind of urban transformation of a former military base, or how do you build a walkable, functioning downtown, as you've done in Center City here with Paul Levy's work. You've got some of the best practitioners and some of the most powerful institutions in the country. The question for a Philadelphia, like any place in the U.S., can 2 plus 2 equals 5? You've got to have a new map now because, you know, again, national government, frolic and detour, state, mired in partisan rancor. If you don't do it at this level, who else is going to do it for
right.
you?
Indeed. Well, what we'll do is I want you to hold that thought because we're going to bring on a great mind that's thinking about those same things to sit in with you on the second half hour. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break. You've been listening to Mr. Bruce Katz, who is the author of The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism, and you will be listening very shortly to Ms. Arshana Sahe, strategic advisor and thought leader here on the Tone and Tenor radio show at WWDB Talk 860 in Philadelphia.
The Tone and Tenor Show is sponsored by Factotum Business and Government Solutions, a unique lobby consulting company that services business and governmental clients through long-standing bipartisan relationships. It is Factotum's mission to provide business solutions for both profit and nonprofit organizations, connecting them to officials in local, state, and federal governments. Factotum has offices in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. For more information on Factotum Business and Government Solutions, call 866-795-4484. That's 866-795-4484.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Tone and Tenor Radio Show. Welcome back here on WWDB Talk 860. I'm Maurice Goodman, along with my intrepid co-host and co-producer and founder of Tone and Tenor, Randall Jefferson. We're here today talking about the new localism, how cities can thrive in the age of populism, and we're speaking with Mr. Bruce Katz, who is the author of The New Localism and also the co-founder and inaugural director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University's Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation. Along with Mr. Katz, we're now going to bring on Ms. Arshana Sahe, strategic advisor, thought leader, who focuses on areas that include innovation and ecosystem development. She is a millennial, but that should not be an excuse at all, because that thought leader part, well, that's a real thing. So welcome, Arshana, to the show, and we really appreciate you being
here. Thank you. I'm an elder millennial. I'm on the old side of millennials.
Well,
elder, I'm an elder.
So now you're a millennial emeritus. Then is that what? So welcome to the show. One of the first things
you're welcome.
One of the first things we wanted to do is book is written by Mr. Katz, certainly, and the late Jeremy Nowak, and we know you worked very closely with him. With Jeremy, and we wanted to first, you know, just honor his memory, because this book is a part of his DNA, and we do know that in the Philadelphia region, and you worked with him directly, so we wanted you to at least give us a sense of his thought process and what his legacy is here, and part of the reasons why we wanted you on is to at least speak to that.
Absolutely. He was a force of nature. Jeremy's legacy, lives on in his writings, in this book, the many institutions he built and supported in Philadelphia, across the country, across the world, and, of course, the people's lives that he impacted directly and indirectly. For me, from what I saw and experienced, he leaves behind a legacy of equity and inclusivity. He made it a point to include new voices in a conversation and gave them equal standing at the table, and he spoke to what he saw. So if something didn't sit right with him, he was not shy about pointing it out. And I hope that that has rubbed off on those who were, you know, lucky enough to be with him. It certainly has rubbed off on me.
Mm. Mm. You have become a thought leader in your own right. And
thank you. That's very generous.
You're welcome. And we know a lot of people out in the region know that you've been pushing considerably for a lot of intergenerational, intergender access. And what are some of the challenges to access you are seeing as this book speaks to the new localism that you're seeing? What voices are not being heard and that should be heard right now at this time and place?
Wow. I mean, so many challenges. I would just say for those to whom the topic of access is important, I pose, you know, a very simple exercise when I talk to them. So when organizing a room, a panel, an event, ask yourself if it looks like the community that you live in. If not, then why? And what can be changed going forward for it to get closer to looking like the community you live in? So diversity, it's not a bullet point. It's not a round table. It is not a panel. It is not a box to check. So you either get it or you don't. And a lot of these legacy organizations, and it's not just a Philly thing, it's around the country, a lot of these legacy organizations say, you know, they're waiting for some set of resources before they can implement diversity initiatives. And, you know, let's look at the last few hires you've made. And the makeup of the team is a pretty good indicator of how important diversity is to you as an organization, as a team. And in terms of what voices are not being heard, I mean, there's quite a bit. Women, communities of color. For me personally, I'm struggling with a lack of representation for the Asian community in various corners of our ecosystem. And specifically as it relates to tech and innovation, we see Asians making up a huge proportion of the workforce, but that is not necessarily reflected in the more senior levels. And I hear it myself, where people will say that Asians don't need the support, the socioeconomically well-off, that model minority myth, and it's challenging. So the Asian community is vast, it's extremely diverse in and of itself, and lumping the community together means there are certain pockets of it that get left behind, that get overlooked, and don't get access to those resources that they so critically need. I don't have any solutions for that right now, but it is top of mind for me, and I'm thinking through ways to address that.
So with that, you are at an intersection of entrepreneurship, social impact, and diversity. Where does entrepreneurship, specifically women-led businesses, play a role in the revitalization of cities and regions?
It plays a huge role, I mean, in the revitalization of cities, given that women make up over 50% of the population. So I believe, though, that it really starts with basic wages. So when you have women earning on average 25, and I say on average, earning 25%, because there are certain demographics that earn 50% less than their male counterparts for the same job, that's 25% less likely that they have to save up to take that risk to start a business. That's to invest in a startup, to build wealth, like real wealth, et cetera. So if communities are truly to thrive, everyone must be able to participate and benefit from its growth. So you can't participate if you aren't being given access to the resources like others are. So it's not that there's a lack of resources for these communities. There's plenty of money out there. There's a lack of direct access. And when the access is there, they're just fraught with so many frictions. So, you know, instead of it taking two steps for me to get, you know, the funding that I need to do whatever, it takes five steps. And that's just time, and time is precious. And there's a very high opportunity cost to that time. And it's extremely high for women, and it's extremely high for people of color, because you're already at a discount because you're not earning the same amount as your male counterparts for the same exact job.
You mentioned that there's plenty of money out there. Somebody listening would say, okay, there's plenty of money out there. Where is it? How do I get to it? You know, and that seems to be one of the problems. You know, we talk about, we have this new buzzword, entrepreneurship, but when we want to move out there to find the funding and try to not just be a mom and pop store, and there's nothing wrong with that, or a barbershop or a beauty salon that we find in our communities, but real. So not real, poor choice of words when I say real jobs, but career-oriented movement. And that person saying, okay, where do I find that money? How do I get to what you mentioned? How do we do it? How do these people?
That's
biggest problem.
I 100% agree, and that's a great question. So I think it's part education and awareness in these communities that these resources exist, and I think it's part what Bruce alluded to with Metro Finance. So when we see the public sector and the private sector and philanthropy come together to say, hey, there are communities, there are neighborhoods, there are corridors that need to get reactivated, how can we be creative in developing financial instruments for them to access this particular resource that's sitting on the sideline, because in its current iteration, maybe it's not something that can be deployed into a particular neighborhood or, you know, lent to a particular person for whatever reasons exist because of the current infrastructure that we have. So if these communities come together and say, really say, like, look, we are going to move the needle on this particular number, whether it's unemployment, whether it's poverty, whether it's childhood education. When that happens, that's what's really, really exciting. So Metro Finance, as Bruce mentioned, it's my favorite chapter in the book because my background is in finance, but also because there's a lot of Jeremy in that chapter. So what I see there is, and I saw it also firsthand when we were working at the City of Philadelphia. So something as innovative as, for instance, the Startup PHL program, which was backed by PIDC, to see a city, double down and say, look, entrepreneurship is important to us, specifically tech entrepreneurship. Let's look at that. And to create this program and create a funding mechanism around it, that's exciting, right? So more things like that, more programs like that, more thinking, more leadership around that is what's needed in our community. And I'm hopeful that when you see examples of Copenhagen and Pittsburgh, Kansas City, that are outlined in this book, that other communities will also stand up and say, okay, so it's not just us. Like, we're not alone in this, right? We're not the only ones kind of grappling with this particular issue. There are other communities, other cities that have dealt with this and have come up with innovative solutions. Let's figure that out for ourselves too.
Indeed. And I'll pivot back to Bruce for that reason, because that's where we left off at the last half hour, talking about Philadelphia and how it might be doing some very innovative things. You were right there in the middle of it as you just spoke, Arshna. Bruce, I would ask it, I'd start this way in carrying on that piece of the conversation. Do you see the book as a template for affecting change? And in doing so, where does Metro Finance fit into that narrative and flowing that discussion?
So I think, at the end of the day, what we have to do in the U.S. and obviously outside the U.S. is create 21st century financial instruments, financial intermediaries, and financial institutions. We're still dealing with legacy instruments, intermediaries, and institutions. So institutions, the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation actually is an example of a 20th century institution that's evolved in really interesting and productive ways. So on intermediaries, I think the University City District and how what was essentially built as a business improvement district doing clean and safe is now running the West Philadelphia Skills Initiative, which is helping low-income residents living in West Philadelphia access jobs at Drexel or the hospitals or other major anchors. That's an example of a 21st century intermediary. On instruments, one thing the national government has done, I'm not sure half the time they know they've done this, but in the middle of this gargantuan tax bill they passed last year, they created something called Opportunity Zones. A good portion of West Philadelphia, for example, is an opportunity zone. And what the federal government has basically said, if you want to defer capital gains taxes, corporation or an individual, you can defer them for 10 years if you would invest in an opportunity zone. And then if you keep and hold that investment, you invest in a real estate deal or a business, you can basically be exempt from future capital gains taxes.
That's an important piece. I really want to dive in on that for a second, and I want to hear Arshna's take on that as well.
Yeah.
Opportunity zones, that's the baby of Senator Cory Booker and Tim Scott, which sounds like prime moment of bipartisan brilliance, one would think, if it works. Do you think opportunity zones will work? And Arshna, from where you sit, Is that a vehicle by which we can start this new piece of new localism? Because it sounds like a good idea on paper. It passed through the tax law. Is it going to work? Bruce.
Well, it'll work if we figure out a way, A, for cities to communicate their assets and advantages, and particularly in these zones. So what are the investable projects in a West Philadelphia, and particularly the low-income portions of West Philadelphia? And if we don't have quote-unquote investable projects today, what kind of steps could we take to get to investable projects, particularly minority entrepreneurs, women-owned businesses? What's it going to take? I think this piece of legislation forces the local. The federal government is not going to write a bunch of rules that gets anyone to make these investments. This is really up to public, private, and civic leaders and institutions locally to basically create the demand for investment. And so I'm very hopeful that in the next 2 years, whether it's Philadelphia or, you know, we're working very closely right now with Louisville, with Los Angeles, with South Bend, with Oklahoma City, there are going to be a group of cities in the United States that I think are going to figure out a way to create the kinds of financial instruments and routines and mechanisms so we can start matching capital to the kinds of businesses and projects that make sense for these communities.
Arshna, you can pick up on that, but as a, as an add-on, what's the difference between this and, you know, Opportunity Zone? Maybe I had to go back to Bruce with this, but I get the sense you, you know this as well, and the empowerment zones of the 1990s during the Clinton administration. What's the difference?
The difference is the empowerment zones were focused on a business that was located in the zone and gave the tax relief to that business. This is tax relief to the investor, which has the promise, therefore, to create routine kind of financial instruments that ultimately will redound to the benefit of not only companies or real estate that are located in zones, but really throughout the whole country. So that's the radical difference here. Empowerment zones focused on the business, opportunity zones focused on the investor.
Arshna?
So what you have there is a mechanism to unlock that capital that's sitting on the sidelines, right, and move that into neighborhoods that perhaps would not have received that benefit. So I think it's a great question about, is this going to work? And I will likely take a more conservative approach and say it will work if the community is represented at the table that the decisions are being made at, and they are also heard, and their voices are considered, and their concerns are considered. So rather than all these decisions being made, we've been saying legacy orgs for a while, 10, 20, 30 years, being made at the tables of these legacy orgs amongst legacy, members and actors in the community, making sure that the folks who will be directly impacted by this type of work are also included. And, there's an example. So I was in Omaha a few weeks ago for a tech conference, and I had the opportunity to go to the community and check out some of the good work that's being done there, and specifically in North Omaha, which is Omaha by and large is like very low unemployment, high wealth. Obviously, we know Warren Buffett lives there. North Omaha is not. So that's not definitely the case. It's one of the poorer sections of Omaha, largely minority community, and there is a great project there that's being led by 75 North, and essentially it's a community organization that came in, took over a huge amount of land there, and has just started reactivating that space, working with the local school, which was, suffering from low scores, poverty, also put an accelerator space in there so the community has a place to like organize and just convene. Coffee shops are going in, so you're seeing this like bubbling of commerce in that particular community. And again, it points to public sector, private sector, and philanthropy coming together. But what really is leading the charge is the president and CEO, Othello Meadows, who is a native of Omaha, left for school, work, et cetera, came back with his family and is just committed to revitalizing that particular space. So the money is needed. Capital is needed. We need to find ways to get to incentivize, investors to get off the sideline. But then at the same time, that has to be married in order for it to work with civic leaders in the community and then the community itself. So these decisions cannot be, decoupled from the concerns of the community. That's the only way, in my opinion, that it's going to work or succeed, I should say.
Which speaks to a different level question. I'm just going to go out on a limb here. You speak of tech. I think of tech and politics. Are we at an age where, because there's this confluence of activism, to Bruce's point about left and right politics, that tech might bring about the moment where maybe some people are hoping there is a radical moderate. There's radical moderates that are engendered. Instead of a left-right dynamic, there is this center dynamic that is very aggressive. Would you Would you venture a guess that that's a possibility that moves us toward where we're going? And books like these are templates that could get people to that space? Because it seems yes, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, books, I mean, not to catch up, books like these are definitely a template for what's going on because you have real case studies from countries or from cities in the United States as well as from around the world. And I don't want to put labels on it of like right or left, et cetera, but I do think there is a move to impact, right? So if you're going to commit dollars to something, if you're going to commit energy, if you're going to commit code, if you're going to commit policy to something, what is the impact that we're going to have on our community? Because there's certainly a strain, at least from my experience of working, you know, in the communities, in the neighborhoods, like you can't just keep taking without giving something back into that particular ecosystem. So I think the example of Omaha was a really, really great one. Mm-hmm. And then when you see the work here in Philadelphia, for instance, of like the Welcoming Center, yes, so Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians provides a soft landing for immigrants in our community. And why that's important is because after decades and decades of decline, population decline in Philadelphia, finally over the last decade, we're seeing our population tick up at a very reasonable pace, and that growth is being led largely by immigrants. So in addition to providing that soft landing for this community, the Welcoming Center also does things like entrepreneurship, and they recently were granted an award from the federal EDC to build pipelines for entrepreneurship between Philadelphia and Europe, and Philadelphia and India, and some of that will be tech entrepreneurship. So, you know, when you consider that 51% of the U.S. billion-dollar startups are led by immigrants, were built by immigrants, that is a huge benefit to any economy, and for Philadelphia, certainly a huge benefit. So I think, you know, left, right, central, et cetera. For me, what I see when it comes to entrepreneurship and tech entrepreneurship in particular, it's about jobs, and it's really good paying jobs. And so it's the impact that it has at a very local level for your community.
That's greatly appreciated. As I understand it, because we have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask this one tiny question. To what is the number? I've been asking this question for a bit. What's the number that immigrants are contributing to the Philadelphia economy? Some say 30%, some say 25-30%. Do you have a close number on that, Arshna?
I don't have a close number on that one, but I can tell you between 2000 and 2016, the city saw an increase of 69% of residents born abroad. And the residents are African residents, Asian, and European that are coming into Philadelphia. Pew has a great report that they published recently about the impact of the immigrant population in Philadelphia. So I would reference your listeners to look that up.
Yeah, the one thing I would just say, if I could just interject for a second, when people ask me what's the most important thing that the national government in the United States did to help rejuvenate cities, what I always say is the Immigration Reform Act of 1955, which opened up the United States to immigrants from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Before then, it was mostly coming from Europe. That is the single most important thing the national government has done in 60 years.
Do you think we will get comprehensive immigration before I die?
Well, we won't get it under this president.
I'm not touching that.
So, whether we get comprehensive immigration reform or not, what we have to do is stop the kind of, not just the rhetoric, but the poisonous policy, which is now punishing immigrants. We are the nation of immigrants, right. and our economic prosperity is completely tied, as Arsha has said, at the national level and at the metropolitan city level, to the fact that we are an immigrant nation. Mm-hmm. So the conversation in Washington, coming from the White House particularly, is really completely contrary to the facts mm-hmm. of how this country is built and moves forward.
Indeed. Greatly appreciate that. We are up against the clock here. What we want to do with the both of you is, if you would, just we'll start with you, Bruce, to tell us how people can get their hands on your book, how they can reach out to you by Twitter, Instagram, et cetera, and then Arshna right behind him.
To get the book, there are Barnes & Nobles in Philly. I think that will be on stock, or you just order from Amazon. If there are any independent booksellers, please support them because they're central to our civil life. In terms of going on Twitter, Bruce_Katz, K-A-T-Z. That's the best way to really engage with me.
Good. Arshna?
Same. So I'm on Twitter, Arshna Sahai, A-R-C-H-N-A, Sahai, super active on Twitter. And I'm trying to figure out Instagram. Like I said, as an elder millennial, I'm trying to figure it out, so you can catch me there too.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we greatly appreciate that. Are there any final thoughts that you might have that you want to convey to our listening audience? Arshna, we'll start with you.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Jeremy's legacy is one of equity and one of inclusivity. And, you know, one of the greatest gifts he gave me was when I was sitting in a room. I always felt like my voice was heard. So when he saw something that he didn't like, he absolutely said something. And when he saw something he did like, he absolutely said something too. So I would just encourage everyone to do the same in the rooms that they're in the communities that they're in. Say something. Speak up for those who may not have the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Bruce?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have Jeremy as a very close friend, as a business partner, as a co-author, and now essentially heading up the NOAC lab at Drexel. And I think our feet should be held to the fire because, as Arshna has said eloquently, there's an enormous amount of capital in the United States. It's not getting to the right places or the right people.
Indeed.
And so we've got to figure out a new way of finance in the United States. So we, and not waiting for Godot, not waiting for the national government to spring back into action, but actually building the new norms from the bottom up. So that's what we'll try to do at Drexel and continuing and burnishing Jeremy's legacy.
Very good. We appreciate that. We'd like to thank our guest, Bruce Katz, co-founder of the New Localism Advisors and co-author of The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism and the Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. He is the co-founder and inaugural director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University's Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation. And we'd certainly like to thank Ms. Arshna Sahai, strategic advisor, thought leader, consultant, whose focus is on urban innovation and ecosystem development. Listeners, follow our show on social media. We greatly appreciate that. On Twitter, we are at Tone and Tenor. To find us on Facebook, just type in www.facebook.com/ToneTenor to find our page. Our studio engineer is Brett Cronenberg. Thank you, Brett. I'm Maurice Goodman.
I'm Randall Jefferson. Thank you for listening to Tone and Tenor, bipartisan voice of the people here on WWDB Talk 860 AM out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.